Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And do you sometimes feel like all of a sudden everyone around you is having babies, or everyone started exercising, or getting sick, or depressed? It might be more than a coincidence. New York Times Magazine contributing writer Clive Thompson is the author of last Sunday's cover story, Are Your Friends Making You Fat? And he looked at research that shows social habits can become contagious. Hi, Clive. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi. How you doing?
I'm not fat, but my friends are making me. Are my friends making me skinny?
Well, if they're skinny, potentially. I mean, it works both ways. What these scientists have discovered is that there appear to be pretty strong influence effects from peer to peer. So if your friends gain weight, you have a greater chance of gaining weight. If they lose weight, you might lose weight. Same goes with smoking. Starting or stopping smoking, even things like drinking or happiness.
And we'll get into causality versus association, but I guess this hypothesis grows out of some long-term research from the famous Framingham Heart Study. What was that?
Well, the Framingham Heart Study was basically, they tracked three generations of Framingham residents for like 50 years, bring them in every couple of years to get all sorts of measurements about their health. These scientists realized that they could actually take that data and figure out who knew who, so they could see whether or not various health effects or behaviors appeared to be spreading from person to person over
who
the years.
Who knew who in that group, in the sample that was being studied?
Yeah, because every time you came in to get measured at the Framingham Heart Study, they'd ask you to fill out a form saying who your family members were, where you worked, the name of a close friend in case they needed to reach you again. And so these scientists basically took that information and constructed this huge sort of, you know, map of all the links between people so they could figure out who was friends with whom.
So there were social scientists, not just cardiologists and epidemiologists in this study, Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler.
That's right.
And what did they find exactly?
Well, basically they found, for example, let's take a look at obesity was the first thing they looked at, and they discovered that if your close friend became obese, you had a 40% increased chance of becoming obese. But here's where it gets really interesting. They discovered it actually goes further than just one link. If a friend of a friend became obese, your chance of becoming obese still went up by like 20%. And if a friend of a friend became obese, literally someone three links away from you, you still had a chance, increased chance, up to 10% of becoming obese. So it's quite spooky. I mean, we're talking about the idea that if someone three links away becomes obese, even if your friend and your friend's friend don't change their weight, that effect can still pass through them to you.
But I don't get it. How does it pass?
Well, that's a really good question. The answer is they don't know for sure, because they're just looking at data and making hypotheses about how this works. But they think it's because it's possible to sort of absorb a social signal without acting on it. For example, suppose I'm at work and I work next to someone who's over a year really gets heavily obese. And I work closely with them. And they might, over that time, slowly change my sense of what constitutes a normal weight. Even if I don't change my weight, I get a sense that weighing 50 pounds more, you know, isn't that weird. And I go home, and I hang out with my family, and I essentially, you know, transmit that attitude to them, so they get the sense, well, you know, if we gain some weight, it doesn't seem like it would bother Clive. And so that's essentially their theory as to how a social norm can pass through someone and affect someone on the other side of you without you necessarily changing your behavior.
So, listeners, what do you think about this theory, and how do you think it applies to your own life? This can go way beyond the question of weight. Do you think that any trends that you were a part of came from your social network? Do you think your mother's best friend's sister had an effect on your health or happiness or when you had kids or whatever? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Maybe you read this article in the New York Times Magazine by Clive Thompson. It was the Sunday cover story, Are Your Friends Making You Fat? So can social contagion be extended to many types of behavior. Obviously, we've been talking about the weight example from the Framingham Heart Study, but you also mentioned happiness, studiousness. Is there a whole lot of social science on this?
Well, you know, here it's interesting. There's been more and more of it in the last 10 years. For decades, I mean, social scientists suspected that behaviors move from person to person, you know, that maybe you pick up smoking with a peer pressure. Some of the stuff is kind of obvious.
Yeah,
some of
it's really
obvious.
No one
had ever thought that it went as far as these guys appear to have documented three links. But here, I'll give you an interesting example of some research that was done by some other researchers. Donald Green and some of his students, they did work looking at whether or not voting, the decision to vote, is contagious. And they ran in kind of a nifty experiment. They had someone go house to house and ring the doorbell and say, "Hi, I'm here to encourage you to vote." And then they would go back. And they came back later to poll all the people in the house and say, did that increase, you know, they checked see whether it increased the likelihood these people would vote. Well, it did increase the likelihood of the person that answered the door, but it also increased the likelihood of voting of everyone else in the household. Even if they didn't answer the door and get the message, just being exposed to the person who listened to that message increased the chance that they might vote. So it does appear, there's evidence trickling in from all sorts of areas that we sort of influence each other quite subconsciously and quite frequently with our behaviors.
The study found that smoking spreads among coworkers, but happiness doesn't necessarily. That was pretty interesting.
Oh, no. That's really interesting because, like, you think of it this way. I wondered about that. I said to these scientists, why is it that a coworker could affect your smoking but not your happiness? And they said, well, they think it's because smoking is a social thing you do, you know, particularly these days where you have to go outside the building with other coworkers. So even if they're not really friends, if they all stop smoking, you're the last one outside the building, and you feel like an idiot, so you stop. Now, happiness, on the other hand, is trickier because at work, you're sort of friends with people, but you're also sometimes in competition with them. If they're really happy, it might be because they got a raise you didn't get. So they think that actually the you get these different balances in the workplace for happiness because we're both colleagues with and competitors with people at work.
But don't the isn't there a psychological mechanism, too, that makes us want to be contrarian, that makes us want to run against?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, there's Schadenfreude, right? You know, like, we could become happy at someone else's unhappiness, right? You know? These guys basically point out that, you know, different types of behaviors appear to spread differently. For example, you know, with happiness, some of this stuff seems very, they think it's very, very deeply subconscious. It's like literally at the level of mirror neurons in our brain. And what those do is they sort of mimic the behaviors you see in people around you. So that, like, if someone, it's why if you see someone smiling, you might temporarily smile yourself, almost involuntarily. And they think that happiness spreads largely because we're exposed to a lot of just small moments of smiling or happiness or laughing or apparent good mood from people all around us.
Right. And I guess, you know, I mean, happiness is just such a more complex state of being. It has to do with what was happening in your home when you were 4 years old and, you know, all that stuff compared to whether you're going to take up smoking. But my question was really about the position of defiance, which, you know, I mean, maybe by definition, being a contrarian is something that's going to exist only in a minority of the population.
Right. Yeah.
So
that's definitely true. I mean, if some people are contrarianness is probably I'm pulling this completely out of my hat. It's probably a contrarian position. But the other problem is that some of the mechanisms these guys are talking about are involuntary. So they're not necessarily going to be affected by one's attempt to be a contrarian, you know? As with the happiness stuff, you know, you can sort of try not to smile or feel good when someone smiles at you. But they've done brain studies that show that you just wind up feeling better. Even if you're like, these people are fake, they're smiling at me in fake ways, I don't like it, it just winds up affecting you, you know? A contrarian, and I'm contrarian on a lot of subjects, requires a sort of an effort of the disposition, and what these guys are talking about tend to be things that are almost sub-disposition. They're deeply psychological.
Clive Thompson with us on WNYC, author of the Sunday New York Times Magazine cover story, "Are Your Friends Making You Fat?" And Anu in Bedford-Stuyvesant. Hi there.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. Are your friends making you drink?
Well, the thing is, I would like to, but somehow wine doesn't agree with me. But I have noticed a large trend with wine. Wine has become this great social gatherer. People are opening up wine boutiques and wine having wine tastings, and just the whole wine thing is just many more people are drinking wine than I used to know who drank wine.
So it's So why wine? Why right now wine? Why isn't it beer? Why isn't it Jack Daniels?
Well, you know, there's the beer thing is going on too. There's all these beer companies and designer beers.
I know you're breaking up. Got to leave it there. We're going to go to Jay Lee in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hi, Jay Lee.
Hi there.
So what are you
thinking?
Can you hear me? Yeah, hear you fine.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is the same as obesity, but when I read the article, the first thing that came to my mind was all of my friends who were getting engaged. I recently got engaged about 5 or 6 weeks ago.
Congratulations.
And within the last 6 weeks, four other friends have gotten engaged. Granted, they were in committed relationships and all of that, but it just kind of got me thinking, like, not that I think I inspired them to get engaged, but I just kind of wonder if it's sort of that, like, my sister has a baby, now it's time for me to have a baby, like, I need to get on with this.
Little,
I don't know if it's related.
Yeah. Clive Thompson, I don't know, maybe jealousy, too, the engagement
example. Let me just pick up on what that last speaker said, because she raised something very interesting. There actually was a study by a young academic at Princeton a couple of years ago entitled, Is Having Babies Contagious? Ileana Kuzimko. And she looked at a bunch of data and discovered that, in fact, when someone has a sibling that if your brother or sister has a kid, your likelihood of having a child in the next 10 years goes up by about 15%. Interesting.
That's interesting. And, you know, I mean, that was also a serious issue in the debate over teenage pregnancy, that there was not the social sanction that there was once upon a time when one teenager would get pregnant. And so the girls started to get jealous in some cases and saying, "Ooh, I want my baby."
Exactly, and in fact, actually, the effect that this woman, this academic found, is highest with women. If your sister has a child, your likelihood of having a kid in the next 2 years goes up by 30%. It doesn't go up as much if your brother has a child. It's more about women, and this makes sense. Like you said, somebody's a sense of competition. You know, it's like, oh my God, they're having a kid. I need to have a kid. You know, like, or maybe they're getting more attention from our parents. So there's a bunch. You can think of a bunch of reasons why it would happen.
In fact, there were some gender-related findings in these studies, weren't there? Like, people are more affected by members of the same gender when it comes to obesity, but when it comes to drinking, women are more influential than men over either?
Yeah, that's right. You think about it. I mean, that sort of made sense to me when I thought about it, because, okay, so what they found was that, you know, if your wife or husband becomes obese, it doesn't affect you as much as if your same-sex friend becomes obese, right? And they think that's partly because we sort of compare ourselves, our bodies, more closely to people of the same gender, right? So if I'm a man, I compare. I don't look at women as a guide to how much I should weigh, but I do look at other men, right? And so that sort of makes sense. The one with women and drinking is interesting. If you're around men that drink a lot, you know, it'll increase your likelihood to drink a bit. But if you're around a woman that drinks a lot, then it much more dramatically increases your chance of drinking. Why is that? Well, I asked James Fowler, the scientist. He said he thinks it's because the fact that women tend to drink less than men means that people pay closer attention to women for the social signal that says it's okay to drink. So if they start cutting loose, that has a bigger effect than if the men start cutting loose.
Tanuha in New Jersey writes on our webpage, approximately 6 months ago, I gave up drinking soda due to the high sugar content. Surprisingly, within that period of time, my boyfriend, mid-20s, and his younger sister, teenager, have also given up soda without any pressure from me. This was a positive result that just spread within my family. Ellen in Mohegan Lake, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I was wondering if the guest had heard of the book, The 100th Monkey. I'm not sure if that's the title, but it's a theory back in the 60s. I'm only 37 years old, so I'm not quite sure if I have the right name, but it's about nuclear war and about a group of people getting together and wanting peace for the world, and they can transcend it through the population. And the theory was the 100th monkey, that if you teach 99 monkeys how to do something, that automatically the 100th monkey will be able to do it just because the 99 were able to do it first.
You know about the 100th monkey, Clive?
I'd never heard of that. That's really interesting. I mean, it certainly makes sense insofar as we know that, you know, we know that there's tipping points in populations that once once a certain number of people around you are doing something, you're more likely to do it. This, you see this in disease also. I mean, that's a threshold effect where, you know, many diseases spread not necessarily because one person infects you, but because a lot, you know, you reach a critical mass of people around you that had a bug, and you're just going to get it, basically.
Yeah, right. That's how I think Barack Obama got elected.
Well, they were also trying very hard to spread the word. They were spending, a few hundred million dollars on that, which raises the whole question of intentionality here, Clive. I mean,
sure.
That post from Tanuha in New Jersey, you know, which said that she didn't try to pressure her boyfriend or her boyfriend's teenage sister to give up soda, and yet it just happened. But can you use this in public health campaigns, for example?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think you can, and I think, in fact, they have. With smoking, it seems pretty clear that the government spent, you know, decades on a very, very extensive, you know, love bombing campaign to get people to stop smoking, right?
Yeah.
And it worked. It basically got people to stop, but it took a long time because they had to reach enough people that you started to get that network effect where there was enough people around you that had stopped smoking that it would infect you too. And now, in the wake of Christakis and Fowler's work, people are thinking that the government, if they're really wanted to be serious about obesity, they would have to do the same type of thing. A very expensive, very long-term, very broadly based anti-obesity campaign, because you've got to get enough people losing weight that that you're not just getting reinfected by people,
right,
that are two or three lengths away from you.
Well, what about other decisions that people might make knowing of this research? I mean, it could get kind of socially ugly. There's a story in the article about a woman who is stressed out because she's caring for her ill mother, and the sadness and stress spread to her husband's friend. So does that encourage us to avoid people if,
sure,
we know that they or even their spouse is stressed out, or if we know our friends are fat and we don't want to get fat, then we avoid those friends? I mean, that's not very good.
No, it's not. And there's even kind of potentially creepy public policy implications if you take it to a logical extreme, right? For example, Nicholas Christakis wrote an essay for the British Medical Journal pointing out that if you took this logic to its absolute extreme, you'd say that the government ought to spend more money keeping healthy people that are really well connected, right? Because they're going to spread that health better than people that are isolated. And he basically said, you know, that's a logical conclusion, but truthfully, you know, he thought it was kind of creepy. He didn't like where it goes. So we can look at the science and say that this is useful, and there are many things we should do with public policy, but you have to be careful not to take it too far, quite frankly.
Or online social networks relevant here? We're talking about social networks in the kind of old-fashioned face-to-face sense, pretty much, but we're connected now with so many people outside of our physical circles of friends and coworkers. Social networking is, you know, such a part of our culture now. Is it the same? Is it different? Do you know?
Yeah. The answer is A, we don't know, but people are looking at this right now, including these guys, Nicholas Christakis, James Fowler, and Robin Dunbar, the guy who identified the famous Dunbar effect, the idea that we have a maximum number of friends we can know. They think, okay, here's what the theory would be. It seems unlikely that the effect is going to be as rich, because we're not going to necessarily pick up the big, rich social signals you get from being physically next to someone, right? Like, you're not going to see them smile. But on the other hand, you know, people can be quite expressive online, you know? They express themselves with other things, with videos, with pictures, with links.
Right.
So, you know, it may well be that we can catch a lot of behaviors from people online. And there are some guys that are trying to figure out whether or not they can use Facebook to spread good behaviors. Like there's Nathan Cobb is a scientist who's worked with anti-smoking. He's designing a little Facebook app, basically with the idea that that if you display how long you've been successfully not smoking, if you display it to your friends, you will set an example, and they'll subconsciously go, oh, you know, Clive has not been smoking for 75 days. That's amazing. I'm going to try and do it. So it may be that we can sort of hack and use Facebook to sort of promote good behaviors as well as just, you know, unconsciously, you know, absorb them.